netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. This is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all of our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, Mike Seymour is going to chat with Dan Lemon about Man of Steel. Dan is with Weta, who did much of the visual effects for the first act, which takes place on Krypton. Dan was visual effects supervisor for Weta. Man of Steel is a film with lots of visual effects, so we've got a lot more coverage coming besides this interview, an article on FX Guide, and more, so keep your eyes out for that. We've also got stories coming on Monster University, World War Z, and an exclusive announcement about a new product launch you want to keep your eyes open for. So let's jump in now to Mike Seymour speaking with Dan Lemon about Man of Steel.
Hey Dan, it's Mike Seymour. How are you?
Good, how are you, Mike?
Good, how are things with you?
Yeah, good, busy, but good.
By the way, where are you at the moment?
I'm in New Orleans right now. I'm on location for the next Planet of the Apes movie.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to being able to talk to you about that when the time is right.
Sure, yeah.
So talk to me about, if I could, just start with the rendering and the look of Krypton. It's, I think, really gorgeous. And
thank you.
What was it rendered in?
We rendered the elements in RenderMan for the most part. Of course, we have our own kind of in-house shaders and kind of plugins and procedures that we add on to the kind of base RenderMan stuff. But, you know, it's all RenderMan and then composited mostly through Nuke in a 2.5D and 3D kind of compositing environment.
The whole system is a physically based or physically plausible shading system now, isn't it? It's can you talk to me about that in terms of lighting and just getting a look right? Is it an easier process now that the machines are more able to replicate real life?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a number of advances we've made over the last 12 years or so that have really increased our ability to more accurately mimic reality. And, of course, that's what it's all about for us. We want our images to blend seamlessly in with photography and for people to, you know, believe the world, to make the world credible. And in order to do that, we try to constantly refine our algorithms to match the real world as closely as possible. We do a lot of sort of cross-pollinization with researchers from different universities. They'll come out to New Zealand for sabbaticals and of course, we'll go to SIGGRAPH and try to follow the papers and actually get the people that are doing the cutting edge research to come over and learn a little bit about how we make movies, and we can learn a little bit about how they mimic, you know, more accurately the movement of light through the real world. And it's a nice kind of symbiotic relationship.
In fact, R&D is kind of one of the big strengths of Weta, isn't it? I mean, it really has a longer-term R&D strategy. You're not just trying to solve the problem that's right in front of your face. You're trying to solve fundamental problems.
That's right. We're always looking kind of forward to trying to push our craft and our art to the next level. And we, you know, as much as anybody else, we see the warts and the flaws in our work, and we, you know, we're constantly striving to try to polish the edges and advance the technology. And that's something that's really championed by our senior visual effects supervisor, Joe Lettieri, who, you know, is a partner in the company and a lifelong striver in trying to mimic reality and get lighting and get shading and our, you know, all the components of our pipeline to be as close to the real world as possible. So we use photographic reference as our, not just our guide, but our master template. And with whether it's painting textures or, you know, scanning displacements, adding bumps and surfaces, the movement of light off those surfaces and through those surfaces, and then also the behavior of the camera, you know, that we're recording the image through, you know, the photographic, optical kind of quirks of different camera systems. We're trying to match those as closely as possible. And on a film like Man of Steel, where, they shot with an anamorphic system and anamorphic lenses, that becomes really important because those lenses are so, peculiar, you know, and have such visual signatures, the way that they render, you know, the world in front of them. If we weren't trying to, you know, match that really closely on the digital end, it would become very obvious.
Yeah, talk to me about that in terms of the lensing of Krypton, because I've got to say it just had such interesting camera blocking, framing, lens choices, some long lens choices. I mean, there were overtones of Apocalypse Now in there for me.
We used Apocalypse Now as a reference for a few shots. Actually, there was you know, they Zod flies in these attack ships, and his descent on the House of El was modeled in some ways after the Ride of the Valkyrie sequence in Apocalypse Now. And in fact, there's a shot that everybody thinks is in Apocalypse Now, which actually isn't. It's in the Apocalypse Now poster that we
the sun shot, the
homage
orange.
To. That's right. The ships flying out of the sun. You know, if you scan the movie, you'll never find that shot in there, but everybody thinks it's from Apocalypse Now because it's on the poster.
Okay, I would totally be one of those people, because honestly, I was that is one of the shots I was referencing, and I love that film and I've seen it many times. But I would have sworn that there was a shot like that coming up on the surfing, but maybe not. Okay, I stand corrected. What about just getting that camera life involved? Like, was it coming from the previs? Because there are sort of, zoom tracking, focusy kind of follow elements where it feels like someone's operating an actual camera on obviously fully digital shots. Was that all something from previs? I mean, when was that sort of introduced? That it's not shaky cam, but it's a sort of sense of real cinematography on a digital camera.
Yeah, I'd say that idea was introduced in the planning stages of the principal photography. And Zach made a conscious decision to shoot this film a little differently than some of his past ones. They decided they were going to go anamorphic, and they decided that they were going to basically put away the dolly and do everything handheld. And even the dolly shots in the movie, which I only saw the dolly come out a few times, and I saw the crane come out only once. And even those shots, they actually used a ride-on crane, you know, a 1930s technology. They sat a person up on the camera operator and put the camera on his shoulder rather than mounting it. So every piece of photography has a little bit of that handheld kind of quality to it. And the dolly only came out a few times, and in that case it was the same thing. Rather than mounting it on the dolly mount, they mounted it on the operator's shoulder who was riding the dolly. So it was a very kind of deliberate decision on the part of the director. And then we just, you know, we tried to emulate that for sure. A lot of the kind of snap zooms and the long lenses were things that they had planned on as part of the previs. We did some previs, and they had some internal previs as well. I think the sequences you're probably thinking about were from the internal previs. We would match those and then clean those up a little bit in terms of just trying to make it feel like not just a, you know, the same way that, you know, lens flares can be done in a way that kind of smacks of artificiality. We tried to make sure that our snap zooms and our you know, wish pans, that they all matched what an operator physically would do.
So Joel is riding a winged creature flying on an alien planet. That does sound remarkably similar to some other projects you've worked on with people riding winged creatures on other planets. But
sure, yeah.
One of the things that I understand you have to do there is be really careful with your sims and gravity, because you're probably having localized gravity to the body doubles. I assume that there wasn't a green screen element. There was just a fully digital shot, right?
That's right. Yeah, I say that's right. There definitely were real elements. We built essentially like a buck, you know, a model on a gimbal that had shapes that matched the saddle and the kind of rough body shape of the winged creature, the Haraka. And we shot elements of Russell Crowe in his, you know, flying costume on that buck, and you know, shook him around, and using the previs as a guide, tried to match both camera and the movement of the gimbal to match that previs. Then we took those elements and put them on, you know, a digital creature in a digital world. But of course, you know, some of the stuff was moved in such a way it wasn't physically possible to get those elements in the buck. So there were shots where we transition in and out, and we'd start, you know, all digital and then go into some Russell Crowe elements for sometimes even just 5 frames or so, and then back out to a digital character.
There's a lot in the film about the, you know, atmosphere and gravity and everything of Krypton being different to Earth, but I didn't sort of visually read that. Is it because people are just kind of normalized in each of the two spaces? Was there any discussion in making the kind of winged motion or the reaction of the characters any different in Krypton than it was from the sort of physics of them running around on Earth?
Yeah, we kind of played. I mean, obviously we were locked into, you know, in terms of the realities of production. We had human people playing on sets that were in Canada, which is not quite as alien as Krypton. And
close, so, but not quite, yeah.
We treated it as if, you know, a Kryptonian in the Kryptonian world, you know, had physics and properties that behaved like, you know, like an Earthling on the planet Earth. But when you put that Kryptonian on the planet Earth, because of the, you know, the harsher environment, their body is... Can do things that the Earthlings never would be able to. And of course you would have seen those laws of physics that you're saying, you know, on Krypton seems sort of normalized. When it came to the Smallville battle, for example, on Earth, the Kryptonians, of course, were behaving in ways that, yep, that no human could. So I think that was kind of the idea of the treatment there, that, you know, what appears, you know, normal in one environment, that same person becomes superhuman in another.
So, quite early on, people start shooting at each other, and there's quite a distinctive kind of phaser blast plasma, which is actually like a plasma residue, which I was really intrigued by. Where'd that come from?
Those were mostly Houdini simulations that our effects team did, and we did our concept artist Michael Pangrazio, who is, you know, a veteran matte painter and one of our part of our internal art department. He did a lot of sort of explorations on what these beams might look like. We wanted to, you know, avoid just a straight laser beam and do something that had a little bit more of interest in it. We knew that a lot of the Kryptonian kind of technology was in the concept art was within a family like cyan blue. But we wanted to try to figure out ways to sneak a little bit of color variation in there and a little bit of variation in movement as well. So we came up with the idea that the beam moves through the air and it charges and ionizes particles within the air, and that, you know, on Krypton there's particles that float in the air the same way there's dust in parts of the earth. But those particles we treated them as if they were heavier or got more excited by the beam, and as that beam, you know, moved through the air, they would glow and they would start to swim a little bit and leave that residue that you notice. And then, you know, particularly when they hit somebody, pieces of the armor or whatever that they would hit would become excited and leap off the armor and swirl around in the air.
But at the armor hits and everything else, that's actually just a simulation, like a kind of some kind of fluidy type simulation. There's no kind of handwork on there.
That's right. It was, I wouldn't say that there was no handwork in that. Definitely the hits were simulations, but they were controlled simulations that were kind of hand-tailored by an artist. And he had two or three guys that were doing most of those things, and they had a rig that they would kind of use to block in, and then they would go in and dial in specific parameters, you know, for those hits and for those moments. And if, you know, somebody got hit and fell down, they would tune it so that, you know, the simulated bits would float in the air for just the right amount of time and then fade out.
Houdini really seems like a brilliant tool for effects animation. I mean, it's just universally the thing that comes up. What makes it so good for doing effects animation?
You know, I love Houdini. It was one of the first packages that I learned when I got into the business and did a lot of effects early on at Digital Domain. And it's something that when I came to Weta, they weren't using a whole lot of, and it took a little while to kind of get people at the company that were used to using Maya and plugins and writing their own plugins to come around to the idea that actually having a tool like that where, you know, with a node graph, one person could set something up, another person could go in and pick that system up and understand the thought process behind how each component works and be able to tweak things at a level that you often wouldn't have access to if you were just using the exposed controls on a plugin. That was something that took a little while for people to come around to, but we hired a few artists that were and support guys that were really good and really knowledgeable in Houdini. And I think it gives us a whole other level of control and speed, in terms of making iterations and changes that if you had to go back and, rewrite a plugin and if the developer happened to be, working on something else, you don't have that same kind of fluidity of an interaction and control. So I'm a big fan of it, and I'm really happy that we've got guys on our team now that are expert users and can do amazing things with it. And of course, that was the same. We used to need to create a lot of those liquid geometry display simulations as well, which were a really interesting blend of animation and modeling and effect simulation. It required three teams to work really closely together, and that was it was a lot of fun to develop that stuff and make shapes that could kind of breathe and dance and transform and communicate ideas in a fluid and an interesting way.
So let's discuss that liquid geometry stuff for a second. So you've got it as the kind of tech of Krypton, really, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of a fairly pervasive cornerstone of their tech. So it appears kind of on robots, but on control panels and in, historical recounts. How hard was it to get that nailed in terms of the look? You were referencing stuff X-Men, was it? Like, that was an initial reference?
That was an initial kind of, I guess, visual idea, the kind of pinboard mapping screen that they had in X-Men, but it was...
this looks considerably different to that.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to go... I think it was something that Zach saw that it was like, oh, that's kind of cool. What if we took that to, a similar idea in that, like, a display that's made up of, moving components that are physically in the space, but let's free it and let's let it float and let's make it into little particle or little bead pellets rather than something that's constrained by a rod or and so we kind of took that and ran with it, and we knew that we needed to make faces and we needed to make displays, things that could show spaceships and could communicate all kinds of information. So we need to be able to be flexible in that, in the way that we distributed beads across surfaces and let them kind of flow in and flow out, and how, how loose they would stick to the surface and how much they would percolate and swarm and change. So a lot of that credit should go to Brian Goodwin. He spent a lot of time going through and adjusting the simulations and trying to find a balance and how the geometry would swim and change.
So they're basically pouring from the back of the display monitor to the front, in the sense that if gravity was there normally, it would go down towards the floor, but you've kind of got gravity coming towards the actor or the viewer who's looking at the thing. And you obviously got some thresholding, but you kind of have a sort of what, the membrane or the inside of a glass kind of version of the geometry, and the beads kind of pour into it. Is that as I understand it?
Yeah, that's sort of a way of thinking about it. The beads sort of pour into a shape that represents the thing that wants to be displayed, and they fill the surface out, and then they also fill the interior volume a little bit as well, but try to hug the surface. And the beads that we were using, they weren't actually spheres. They were they're little tetrahedra, little four-sided. It's as if you took a four-sided pyramid and intersected it with a sphere and used that four-sided pyramid to lop off and flatten the sides of the sphere. So each kind of bead had four semi-flat sides that were joined together by like sort of spherical boundaries. And that allowed us to create almost, a semi-flat surface with little beaded objects.
So when they need to form up to a more solid object, such as the key, with the characteristic Superman S on it, I understand that you actually could just scale them to give them solidity. In other words, they sort of merge into each other. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We treated them as if they were they had the ability to subdivide and subdivide and subdivide, so that they could kind of be big and chunky when they were not displaying anything, or if the thing was large and didn't need a lot of detail. But if they needed to make an object that was, you know, quite fine and quite solid, they could, you know, subdivide down to, you know, the level of like a, you know, a grain of sand or something, and then fuse together. Thought of it sort of like a selective laser sintering process. You know, there's a rapid prototyping technology where you spread a layer of grains of metal basically across a surface, and use a laser to melt them together, and then spread another layer and melt those together. And when you're done, you can, you know, just shake off the dust, and you have a metal object. And so we were kind of doing something similar in a way, but without the actual having to have the layer in between. They could form together and fuse and become a single object.
Now, I know I'm not the first person to joke about this, but, you know, obviously in this super high-tech society, all the monitors are black and white. So my question is,
yep.
How hard was it to get things to read, given that you couldn't use color, and given that these sort of grayer shapes sometimes are flattened, like in the historical recount of the history of Krypton. So you're trying to get things to read where really, you know, you sort of got a couple of hands, or a hand tied behind your back is what I'm trying to say, because you've not got color and you haven't got the kind of depth cues that you would normally have.
Yeah. It was definitely a little bit of a challenge, but a fun creative challenge. But a lot of the reference we were looking at was, for these displays, and particularly for that history of Krypton, a lesson that happens in the Fortress of Solitude. The reference we were looking at was Greco-Roman bas-relief sculptures and, Byzantine sculptures and in a more kind of contemporary reference, you know, the Rockefeller Center has some similar kind of bas-relief sculptures, but they're stylized in a sort of an Art Deco way. They're like a blend between an Art Deco and a Greco-Roman kind of bas-relief. And that was kind of one of the key references we looked at, because we wanted to tell the story in a way that was similar to those frieze sculpture panels that you'd find in Greek and Roman sculptures, and lay things out in a way that could, you could, with a little bit of narrative, see some images that supported that history, but also keep them stylized and graphic and a little bit not quite photographic, but more like an artist's hand had been involved in rendering these images.
So if that was building up the tech of Krypton and obviously allowing us to see what was going on, I can't imagine those sims were as hard as the destruction stuff that was going on outside the chamber. I mean, you guys did the destruction of Krypton, and that must have... how much is your sort of pipeline set up for just doing that? It doesn't seem routine, but I mean, is it almost to that level?
I wouldn't call it routine, but I mean, we certainly built on tools that we've used in the past. There's a lot of handwork involved as well. You know, a lot of these sort of big simulations, people think that it's a computer program, and you say blow up the building or blow up the city, and it goes away and cooks numbers and outcomes a broken building. But for these kind of big events, it can get very chaotic and very hard to read if you're not careful. So it has to be sort of artistically designed in a way so that you can see what's going on, and that it makes an image that's where your eye can follow, and you can see the details that you want to see. And all of that takes a lot of handwork. In a lot of ways, our digital destruction tools are a lot like the way that you might blow up a building, might blow up a miniature. You pre-score areas and you make decisions about, okay, I want this explosion to go off first, and I want this explosion to go off second, and I want to layer things up so that we see all the detail of that piece coming down, and this piece can fly in the air. And you have a little bit more control than you would if you were actually using pyrotechnics and miniatures. But but the ideas are still the same. You're making deliberate decisions beforehand about how to compose things in a way that they'll be legible and interesting.
So the ships themselves that are busting up, are they the same? I mean, are those sort of pre-broken models? I mean, what's the, you know, you don't have a finite element analysis kind of approach to the structures. Are you, like, how are you defining those breakup patterns?
We you know, we'll go through an animation process where we'll do kind of that, those decisions. We'll, with some lower res puppets, animate the ships, let them kind of crash through one another, and then sort of figure, okay, the wings are going to make contact here. We'll bend these pieces out, do sort of a fine pass in the animation where we actually break pieces and snap pieces off and kind of rough in some, you know, orange spheres for explosions and kind of plan everything out that way. And then we'll go back and we'll do all that work over again, but we'll do it on the high-res models. So pre-score things and make panels that can rip away, and it's sheared and indented and scored, and then we'll run those panels through our simulation tools and set off different explosions and fires and smoke, and kind of chain them up and set them off all at the right time. And then we'll also run big rigid body simulations as well, but let things actually, you know, release off the animated piece and run through the system as dynamic objects.
It seemed like there was almost sort of a bushfire sort of sense. I mean, it was great to see. It really had like smoke in the air. There was a lot of stuff burning. Sometimes, you know, these things can be a bit clean. Again, was that always the intent? I just liked the kind of hazy look that you managed to get on. The planet seemed to have a lot of atmosphere and a lot of particulate in the air.
Yeah, that was definitely a deliberate decision. It was partly there to help solve some problems with, so most of that battle sequence were flying through Krypton City, and most of Krypton City is essentially underground, you know, where it's sheltered by these giant soaring rock arches that act almost as like louvers and let, you know, shafts of light through, but not a whole lot. So the exposure balance was really critical, in that we wanted to be able to see the lights in the city and keep things low enough, not, you know, dim enough that the lights from the towers and the buildings would show up. But then we also wanted to have enough light in there that we could pick out shapes of ships and that. So everything was kind of lit and composed in such a way to try to make the action legible. So we'd throw shafts of light down through those arches and illuminate patches of city on the ground to create a bright shape to silhouette a ship against as a ship went by, and then as a ship went into darkness, hit it with a plasma blast and blow it up so that you could see the fire against the dark shapes. So it's kind of careful orchestration. In some ways, it's fairly contrived, but I think in busy sequences like that, it's important to compose things so that you can actually, you know, see what's going on and tell who's good and who's bad and who's winning and who's actually getting hit. The one thing that drives me nuts in some, you know, big action sequences is when you can't actually, it's just noise and you can't actually tell what's going on and who's doing what.
Yeah, you sort of disconnect, don't you, and say, okay, well, when you're finished with the battle, let me know and I'll pay attention again because I'm kind of lost as to what's going on.
Exactly. Like, let me know who wins, and then we'll carry on.
I'm wondering, did you guys do the suit work on the sort of armor type over the extra sort of layer of armor and stuff that appeared over actors?
We did a ton. We did a ton of that on Bulbasaur and Jor-El in Krypton, and then all the men that are wearing armor in the spaceships, the interiors, we would have been doing that. It's interesting, they made a decision to build physical armor for the women, but the men's armor, they wanted to be bulky, and they were concerned that it wouldn't be able to move the way that they wanted it to move. It was actually a physical, built piece. So all the men's armor was digital.
Was it hard tracking those on? I mean, what sort of camera tech did you use to get really good tracks? Because obviously the actors are moving around, you don't want their heads to float relative to the armor. Or is the armor a bit loose and it was sort of forgiving?
No, I'd say it was pretty, it had to be pretty precise, like you say, it would look like they had bobbleheads or like their heads were sticking. So we had, the actors, of course, were wearing suits on set that had some tracking dots on them. And we, you know, we photographed them with witness video cameras from a number of angles. So that allowed us to you know, see them from multiple places and track points on pretty precisely, and get a good feed on their, you know, the way that their body was moving. But sticking the heads is always kind of the difficult last part. And to do that, we just had to go in and do, you know, make some hand adjustments sometimes. We would a method where we would put tracking dots on our animation puppets and make sure that they stick really closely to the photography, and with methods of making fine adjustments and checking them. And that was the last kind of 5%, critical 5%, but a lot of times was as hard as the first 95%.
So I was going to say that lighting was good as well, because the lighting on those suits had to match their faces so accurately and seemed to sit there so realistically.
Yeah, critical.
It was the materials of them, we don't know what they were, of course, but they just seemed to have a real physicality about them. There was a lot of subtlety in the materials, even though it's kind of shiny, kind of armor type stuff. It seemed to have quite a delicate amount of fine detail.
Yeah, the detail is certainly key, and making sure the details of the appropriate scale, and that you have a good mix of scales of detail in the armor, especially when you're doing things that are kind of black on black on black. You have to pick out the shades and the tones and the breakup and the rhythm of the texture, and just make sure that it carries it, you know, in wides and in close-ups and everything in between. We had a really good, perfect reference in a lot of our shots, because, like I was saying, the women wore physical armor that was there on the set on the day. So we could use that as a pretty good baseline for, you know, the kind of detail that we needed to carry in ours. And then we got a lot of lighting reference as well.
But when Joel is fighting for his life and losing, obviously, they weren't wearing armor. That was just all wetter work tracked in.
That's right. Yep, they were. Yeah. They were wearing our sort of motion capture suits. We call it faux cap at wetter for kind of fake motion capture. It's essentially suits with black and white dots in them, and we use the video reference to generate track those points and then generate motion from that.
Look, it might be a naive comment because, and feel free to laugh, but it just seems to me like when you've got a spaceship destructing outside in a wide view where it's fully CG, there's a lot of room to move. And if something goes a bit left or a bit right, it's artistically valid and it's fine. It seems to me that while those are bigger shots in one sense and more spectacular, the close quarter fighting armor, looking like they're actually on the actors and having the physics that feels like they're reacting as well as kind of going with whatever the actor indicated would be, you know, their interpretation of that punch, just seems like meticulously good work.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we really, we worked really hard on it to try to make it as believable as possible. And so a lot of that credit goes to, Zach and Damien Carroll, his stunt coordinator, who, you know, worked with the actors and worked with their stunt team to make, really good, interesting fights. And they...
But I think you're being a bit modest there, because no offense, but I mean, I don't know why I'm saying no offense. I'm applauding the work you guys have done, because if Russell Crowe makes a decision, as an actor does, that maybe doesn't work with the physics of wearing the heavy suit, because he's, you know, trying to interpret the role at the same time as act out as if he has this stuff on, you have to marry both the physics of the suit and the inertia that it might dictate with the whatever the actor did in reacting to whatever's going on. And the whole time, someone like me sitting there is completely oblivious to the fact that, like, you know, a third of the shot is covered with digital armor. I think it's spectacularly good work.
No, that's good. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we certainly were making, you know, we make adjustments as we go along. Occasionally we'd re-speed the shots a little bit. We'd accelerate a punch or a reaction to a punch and carry things a little bit a little bit further, a little bit harder. But like you point out, it's important to try to get the best performance out of the actors as well, to get them to throw punches and to react to the punches being thrown in a way that makes the fight believable. And that's something that if it's not done well, it doesn't matter how well we do with the look of the armor. If you don't believe the punches, then the fight's going to fall apart.
And I remember hearing a Sid Graff talk done by Weta on Iron Man, and there, you know, we have a similar thing, except for the fact that in some of those situations, the armor would come up around the head, and so you've really got a face that you could remove and move to match the body poses that the armor sort of dictated.
Yeah.
I know it's similar kind of work, but here, like Joel's outfit kind of stops around the neck, and we can really see his neck and his head, you know, quite clearly, and it's not as sort of a tight fitting, you know, you have this real sense of his body sitting under the suit. Anyway, I just thought it was really, really nice work. And it kind of amazed, because I assumed that a lot of that stuff was a real physical suit, but it shows how good your work is.
That's good.
I guess, you know, it's an alien spaceship that's digital because we don't have alien spaceships, and you can probably guess that someone wasn't fired with a plasma cannon, but you just assume a guy in a suit's a guy in a suit. But anyway, well done.
Yeah, thank you.
Was there anything you were particularly pleased with in terms of this particular project? You know, anything either from a technical point of view or an aesthetic point of view that you really look back on and were happy about?
Yeah, I always like any opportunity I have to make a world that people haven't been to kind of do something kind of visually new or take people on a ride into a place they haven't seen before. So I really enjoyed, creating Krypton and being able to kind of flesh out a place that, you know, while people, you know, would be familiar with from the Christopher Reeves films and from the comic books, it was, the interpretation for this film was something completely new and different, and that was a lot of fun. And of course, you know, destroying Krypton was pretty great too. I really liked just kind of thinking about, based on what they were saying in the dialogue, in terms of the planet's core becoming unstable and the civilization being on the brink of collapse, interpreting that visually and kind of figuring out, okay, so based on what we know about what they've said, what would happen if the planet were to collapse on itself? What could that maybe look like if we, you know, play it as a geothermal event that's influenced by the planet's magnetic field, and then maybe have it collapse, you know, along the equator rather than kind of blow out spherically and then implode first and then explode afterwards, and kind of playing around with those ideas, I thought was a lot of fun and let us do some thinking and some visual exploration, as well as kind of our, you know, normal just making shots work.
Yeah, well, I think it's great work, and thanks for taking time off set to talk to us. I hope I haven't disrupted your day too much, but I do appreciate it, especially I think you're giving up your Sunday, your one day off.
My pleasure. That's all right.
Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to Dan and Mike for that. Like I said, we've got a lot more coverage of this film coming up on FX Guide and all of our other areas, articles, possibly at FX Guide TV. So keep your eyes open for that. I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we've got quite a few news stories coming up. We've also, it'll be worth your while to check out some of the stories that we've had over the last month or so at FX Guide. If you haven't been keeping track, we've had just a whole range of topics covering business issues, as well as product announcements and just the kind of stuff you'd come to expect from FX Guide. So I encourage you to go check it out. And also, while you're there, check out our FX Insider program. It's our membership program that offers insiders exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people that care about visual effects and the work that we do here to help us continue and grow. You can go to fxguide.com and click the FX Insider tab. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is the FX Podcast, and we also do two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as classic films. The RC Podcast covers digital cinematography. And we produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find out all about these, along with in-depth articles and more, at fxguide.com. Also, check out our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.